This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Climate change has already made the United States poorer, Arizona economics professor Derek Lemoyne reports. How could carbon from our tailpipes make the sea acidic, really? How does that work? Tulane chemist Bruce Gibb explains with a great 15-minute mini-lecture on Radio EcoShock. Welcome, I'm Alex Smith. Most of us are under a money siege. Everything costs more. The scam economy is flourishing. Billionaires feast. Isn't it a stretch to blame any of that on climate change? Let's ask an expert. Climate change has already made the United States poorer. That study was published November 7, 2025, in the prestigious journal PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The findings come from Dr. Derek Lemoyne. Derek is professor of economics at the University of Arizona and co-director of the Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. From Tucson, Derek Lemoyne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Affordability, it's a hot political issue these days, and some of our listeners may be feeling poorer, but isn't it a stretch to blame any of that on climate change?
I can't attribute any given listener's situation to climate change. We can just look at aggregate data around the country. We can relate income. We have data on income at the county level. We have data on weather at the county level. We can relate these two things. And when you relate them, there is a connection. Years with hotter days in a given county typically tend to have lower income. I can't say exactly why that is or what's the channel, but with one caveat I can get to. But you know, the relationship is there statistically in the data.
Well, lots of reports predict future economic penalties, you know, by the year 2100 or something for more greenhouse gases. What stimulated you to figure out costs that are already happening?
Yeah, so by and large, I've been somewhat skeptical of our ability to produce numbers about impacts in 2100 or at any future date. And even though those numbers are pretty critical to figuring out what policy should be, I mean, the whole idea is that we're producing emissions that affect the economy way out into the future, and we need to know what those effects are to understand whether and how much to control emissions. And I've been skeptical about our ability to really know that number. But then thinking about it, it's like, well, if we can't say what climate change is already doing. I mean, that seems like an easier question because we at least we're in the current economy we want to evaluate, and at least we already have the data that we need to do that. So let's at least take that first step, the thing that we'd have to be able to do the bigger picture question, and just see how well we can do that. And then, you know, and that maybe that will inform the other enterprise. But I wanted to know whether it could be done, and then on top of that, just, you know, the question itself, it has merit, because you can then take that answer and think about where should you invest in adapting to climate change, how should you report this as a regular economic indicator, maybe on the par with others that we regularly produce. So if I can come up with a methodology, this could be a number that we could then look to regularly.
Are you finding increased costs due to more billion-dollar weather disasters hitting the United States, or is this more a loss from steady shift in daily temperatures?
That's a great question. It's completely the latter. I'm not looking at anything about extreme events. This is really just day-to-day temperatures shifting all around the country.
But there's so many factors going on. We're in a rapidly changing business environment. How did you sort out climate costs in this study?
Yes, that's part of the key. And in a way, I think that's why it's easier to do this study than to project way in the future. When, I mean, imagine we're 1900 projecting for today. We have no idea what the economy would look like or how it'd be affected by weather. But we have years of data on weather and on income. Again, we can see how these things are related in the data. We have climate models that are very good at replicating historical climate, and they can tell us what the climate would have been without a human contribution, and we could see what it actually was in the data. The difference between those says how many more of the hotter days and how many of the changes in warm and cold days are due to climate change. And so then I have a theoretical framework that brings these things together where I can then say, okay, climate models say the weather changed this much because of humans. The data say that changes in weather tend to have this effect on income, and this is the total effect. The key thing, though, is that what you don't want to do, and what I'd say most prior work on related topics has done, is that you don't want to just look at the effect of changing temperatures today or this year in this particular location. the whole deal with climate change is it changes temperatures in a more persistent fashion, and it changes them everywhere all at once. And so the real novelty of the framework was trying to incorporate that persistence and the widespread nature of climate change and do something quantitative with that. And I find that's really critical. If you ignore that, you find very small effects of climate change from just changing the weather where I am now. But once you account for how weather everywhere changes and changes in a persistent way, then those effects start accumulating, suggesting that trade is an important channel.
Economists and business people talk about the value of capital. We call our system capitalism. Should banks and investing institutions include something like climate depreciation in their reports and plans?
Yeah, I don't have an opinion on whether they should break out climate depreciation, but certainly they need to be thinking about all sorts of risks. Climate change is clearly a risk to many kinds of investments, and to the extent that's a risk for their investments and to the extent it depreciates capital faster, it should be in those numbers. Whether it needs to be broken out, I don't know, but certainly the risk of climate impacts and the risk of policy, which could also affect their quality and value of their investments, is something that should be incorporated like any other risk.
Everybody's concerned with rising prices. Is climate change part of inflation, and how could you know that?
Right. So that's a good question. So what seems to be happening, I believe the reason why I'm finding that climate change around the country matters for income in a given location is I can show that basically it appears the channel is to trade, as I mentioned, trade within the country, not between this country and other countries. That suggests that it actually is a price channel. And so like one example could be, and this is consistent with the findings in the paper, that you might imagine that extreme heat hurts you if you're a corn farmer in Iowa. It's going to make your productivity lower, and that's bad for your income. But if you're the only one who gets hit, then that's really not a good thing for you. But if all the other corn farmers also get hit, then there's less corn on the market, and prices go up, and you could actually be better off, even though you have lower productivity. And the data are consistent with those kinds of patterns, where if you're the only one who gets hit, then you have a hit, then you're hurt. But if other producers also get hit, then you're helped. But consumers everywhere else are hurt because prices went up. And so it does seem like there's a price channel. I'm not going anywhere near in this paper trying to decompose recent inflation into climate change or not. And I think there are plenty of other reasons for recent inflation. But I do think that there is a price effect of climate change.
You built your formula, as you say, from very specific data, drilling right down to daily temperature records over decades, and you did it all at the county level. Why that detail?
It's important to go to the county level. You need daily temperature in order to capture extremes. If you look at monthly averages, then the average temperature in a month might not reflect the hottest days in the month. And so we think that these extreme days actually might matter, and that's consistent with what I found, that like the extreme heat and cold do matter differently than like moderate heat, moderate cold. And then at the county level, that's really got advantages because when you do things at states, they're just statistically, it just doesn't work as well. There's just what we would call fewer observations. So getting down to the county level, you're getting down to a more granular economy where you can start to think about, you can just do tests that you can't do at the state level. Like the linkages are just a little bit different and a little closer to where people actually live and work. And you also know what the weather is better. At the state level, a lot of states have a lot of different kind of weather inside of the state. At the county level, counties are a lot more homogeneous. You kind of know you can better calculate what the weather would be that's actually affecting people.
The U.S. company First Street estimates a potential loss of real estate values of almost $1.5 trillion in just the next 30 years due to climate-related risks. Did you include property values in your study?
No, not unless it's directly related to changes in income in a location. And the kinds of risks that they're talking about are likely to be risks due to things like extreme storms and sea level rise that were not the kinds of risks I was studying in this paper. So that's probably a number that's got some relation, but is not closely related to what I was doing here.
There's another twist in calculating weather costs. Americans are famous for moving around. Do population shifts affect the overall economic figures for climate costs?
That's a great question. That's an example of what economists call adaptation. To the extent that people are moving in response to climate change or in response to weather, that will be one way of adapting to climate change. Where that comes in, because I'm not projecting in the future, so I'm taking whatever the current population is, I'm taking that for granted. the main assumption I have to make there is that without climate change, people would have been living in the same place as they are now. That's obviously not perfect, but it's a better fit to the recent economy than it would be to the next 100 years, because there's only been so much climate change to date. It's relatively new that like people are seeing it and experiencing it. Whereas in 100 years, I mean, everybody's going to have sorted based on everybody will have had plenty of opportunity to have sorted based on weather and based on knowledge of climate change. So I do have to assume that population is people basically live where they would have lived anyway without climate change. And the economy basically looks like what it would have looked like otherwise. We would have still had the internet. We would have still had the similar technologies that we have now. But, you know, it's just that we have a different distribution of weather.
When we think about the frontline economic casualties of climate change, we tend to think of Californians and their fires and Florida's displaced by hurricanes. But you found the biggest losers in this race in a surprising part of the country. Tell us about that.
Right. Once you start accounting for the effects of trade, the losses become very widely distributed. So when you think about if we were to reduce climate change to just these shifts in weather where I live and nowhere else changed, only where I live, then you do get different places that are benefiting and losing. But once you account for the fact that all the counties in the U.S. are linked and that weather in other counties is also going to affect income in my county, that's when you get bigger losses that are noisy. They're uncertain, but they are bigger. And you also get the losses being much more widespread. So there's a small pocket of the country in the far north that looks like it's benefiting, but the vast majority of the country is losing once you account for the widespread nature of climate change.
So what are the figures you came up with after your calculations?
So the central estimate is that climate change is already reducing income by around 12%. That's a number that's on the order. When you think about big ticket policy proposals, like a big ticket reform to immigration or a big ticket reform to maybe tax law or something like that, but like not like a small change, but like a large change, those kinds of changes have impacts in the same order of magnitude. So climate change is looking like something like a big policy reform. It's an uncertain number. I mean, the confidence interval stretches from like 2% to upwards of 20%. But that central estimate in my main specification is around that 12% mark. And in almost any way I do the data, it's somewhere in that like 7 to 12 type region.
What is that 12%? Is that a loss of GDP or what?
The 12% reduction in income per capita today due to climate change.
Oh, so that's individuals losing about 12% of their spending power, let's say, just because of climate change.
Correct. That's what it seems to be in the data.
That's a big hit already.
For spending power, I should also know what happens to prices. So this is only the income side. So if prices also went down, then that spending power would be affected. But if you which I don't think you should hold prices fixed, but if you did, and I can't really say how they changed, then yeah, it would be a big hit to spending power.
The economist Adrian Bilal at Harvard says the potential losses from a 2-degree C rise over pre-industrial levels would be an economy basically like the 1929 Great Depression, but forever. Now, given what you've seen so far, Derek, do you find those kind of dark scenes credible?
That study takes a very different approach. What they're doing is they're taking, I believe, national level data on GDP, and they're relating different economies' GDP to just global temperature. They need to make a few more assumptions and then they're projecting going forward in the way that I'm avoiding doing in this paper. There's some statistical advantages to you. You asked why I use counties. Counties allow me to sort of take care of anything that's so in a given year, income all around the U.S. tends to be higher or lower because the world economy is doing better or worse, or because there's a new technology, or because of policies in the U.S., or whatever else might be going on. And some of those changes might just happen to correlate with changes in temperature. So by using a bunch of different counties, I can look at the changes in county-level income that are different from what happened to all counties in common, and the changes in county-level weather that are different than happened to everybody in common, which allows me to be sure that I'm picking up the effect of weather and not the effect of new technology X or global trade policy Y that just happened to correlate with temperature. They can't use that same approach in their studies, so there is always some uncertainty about whether they're really picking up the effect of temperature. And they are also attributing their effects to extreme events that are driven by global temperature rather than to these sort of trade channels that I'm talking about in my paper.
Surely business must be seeing these climate costs coming into their books. You work with something called the Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. Tell us about that.
Yes, thank you. The consortium brings together electric utilities and policymakers and academics, and what we're trying to do is think about big picture questions that are coming down the pipe for the energy industry. So there, climate change is posing physical risks that need to be dealt with. In particular, we're doing a lot of work on wildfire risk right now. And so then there are questions about what should investments today be and what should the policy infrastructure be to facilitate those investments in order to mitigate these risks that are, you know, in some places already more real, but are only going to be amplified and growing as time goes on. So what can we do today to prepare for coming climate risks?
From the University of Arizona in Tucson, we've been getting the economic impact of climate for Americans from Dr. Derek Lemoine. His November 2025 paper is Climate Change Has Already Made the United States Poorer. Find links to follow up in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. Derek, thank you for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Acid ocean? How? Pardon me, I'm stuck on how a gas becomes rock and changes survival in the whole ocean. There is some kind of mass magic here, well hidden from human understanding. Last week on Radio EcoShock, two scientists warned ocean acidification has already passed the planetary boundary for safety. Check the show website at ecoshock.org for those interviews with top scientists Richard Neely and Helen Findley. But frankly, I still don't get it. I want a physical scientist to explain ocean acidification to me like I'm an 8-year-old. Luckily, a Louisiana chemist just wrote an approachable article about all that in the journal Nature Chemistry. I called him up. And here is our conversation, including a 15-minute mini-lecture for the public on the actual process of ocean acidification. Carbon is really the magic Houdini of elements. It can be a rock, part of living things, a gas in the air, and many chemicals in the sea. I wish it was easy to understand exactly what happens to our carbon emissions when they get into the ocean. How does a chemist see it? Dr. Bruce Gibb is an expert in aqueous supramolecular chemistry at Tulane University in Louisiana. Bruce wrote an essay on ocean acidification, published November 3, 2025, in Nature Chemistry. The enigmatic title is Extinguishing the Saturation Horizon. It describes little-known costs to changing carbon levels in the environment. From New Orleans, Bruce Gibb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Scientists tell us about a third of human-made carbon emissions are captured by the sea. Without that, we would likely have overheated long before now. Are there limits to how much carbon dioxide the ocean can absorb?
Yes, and maybe not. So that's a rather complicated question. It sounds fairly straightforward. But there are both the total amount of carbon dioxide that we need to think that can be absorbed by the ocean. And then there's the rate by which the carbon dioxide is being absorbed. And so we have to factor both of these things into thinking about the problem of ocean acidification. So in theory, given enough time, yes, the oceans could absorb all the CO2 in the atmosphere that we're pumping out through global warming. Pumping out through burning of hydrocarbons and petroleum products. But it's the rate by which we are generating the CO2 that is the problem, because the ocean, although it's very good in the long term at absorbing the CO2, does so very slowly, much more slowly than we pump it out. And so that's the problem, is that there's a catch-up, there's a delay time. And in the meantime, the oceans are becoming slightly more acidic than they are naturally because of this lag time in absorbing and using up the carbon dioxide that is dissolved.
Before we dig deeper into that, I'm sure a couple of listeners are wondering, what is aqueous supramolecular chemistry?
So Supramolecular chemistry deals with the interaction of molecules, how one molecule interacts with another. It's something that happens all over the universe. It's happening inside us with proteins and medicines we take, for example. The aqueous part is, of course, just referring to water. So when you have two molecules that interact, they interact with each other in a different way depending on their environment. So if you're in an organic solvent, you might get one type of interaction. If you're in the gas phase, you might get another. And water tends to be quite different, a sort of third place, a third universe by which molecules interact. And so we're just really focused on molecules, how they interact and what we can do with that, but working within water.
Could you describe the process that makes the ocean more acidic as the atmosphere builds up more carbon dioxide?
Okay, so to do that, it's probably best to take a step back or two. And what we need to be thinking about, the big picture take-homes that we want to store in our brains, are two topics. One is the inorganic carbon cycle, and the second is the nature of acidity. What is an acid? So let's start with the first of these, the inorganic carbon cycle. As you mentioned in your introduction, the element carbon is utilized or used and found in all sorts of places, in the atmosphere, in us, in rocks. And the inorganic carbon cycle is part of the overall carbon cycle of the planet, which deals with what life isn't. So the rocks, the atmosphere, these are dynamic processes or involve dynamic processes, but it's all inanimate. And so when we think about the inorganic carbon cycle, if we start off with, say, the rock reservoir that is the bulk of our planet, the crust is composed in large amounts of calcium carbonate and carbonate silicate-based minerals. And in fact, if you add up all the carbon on Earth, including the life forms in every way, shape, and form that we see in the world, 99% or more of the carbon is actually in the rocks. So these are the important part of the inorganic carbon cycle. Now on the seafloor, at the subduction zones where the tectonic plates meet, these minerals are taken down and buried deep within the mantle. And under high temperature and high pressure conditions that you find there, carbonate sediments from the ocean and silicates are combined to form a variety of minerals that ultimately react and generate carbon dioxide. So that carbon dioxide leaks out of the Earth. It leaks out through volcanism, through volcanoes, through thermal vents on the seabed, soda springs. That carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere as I said, carbon dioxide. So we've got carbon in the rocks. We've got them reacting under the high pressure and temperature, releasing CO2 into the atmosphere. What happens there? In the atmosphere, the CO2 combines with water in the atmosphere. And so when it rains, it's not raining pure water, but it's raining water with some carbon dioxide dissolved in it. That solution of carbon dioxide is ever so slightly acidic, and we'll come to acidity in just a minute, but it's slightly reactive, and it causes the minerals on land to slowly dissolve. And so there's weathering, very long-term, slow process, but you know, you're probably familiar, of course, with carbonate minerals and chalk and all the caves that can form by the dissolution of these carbonate minerals into the water, into the cooled on the surface from rainfall. Those carbonate minerals themselves end up in the ocean, obviously through rivers, and ultimately are pooled with all the other resources of carbonate materials on the ocean floor and so the cycle continues. So we have this inorganic carbon cycle that basically involves rocks being heated, giving off CO2, CO2 going into the atmosphere, CO2 getting pulled out of the atmosphere by rain, washing and reacting with rocks and moving the carbonate back in. And so this cycle continues. And that cycle is a very, very slow process, obviously. It takes a long time to form a cave. It takes a long time for plate tectonics, for plates to move in plate tectonic processes. We're talking geological timescales. So that's one part we need to be familiar with. Now, of course, as life, we have utilized this carbon, this inorganic carbon cycle, not only for building ourselves. You know, you can think of bone is in large part composed of these carbonate minerals. You can think of teeth. We ourselves have utilized calcium carbonate as blackboard chalk. We also use it to form lime, which is another calcium mineral, which is used in cements and plasters. And, of course, all the life, or much of the life in the ocean, if not all of it, has utilized some of these carbonate salts heavily. And so you have crustaceans, which have shells that are composed of these carbonate minerals in large part. And phytoplankton as well have shells that are composed of calcium carbonate. So life utilizes this carbon, this inorganic carbon cycle, in all sorts of ways, both for growth and development, but also just for utilization in hand. So why is all that tied to acidity? So we've got to take another step back and talk about acidity and what is this acidity. So acidity in the most general terms is, well, let's take another step back. Let's go to the element hydrogen, the most abundant element in the universe. Most molecules and chemicals contain some form of hydrogen, and so we can think of water, H2O, so that's one oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms. And hydrogen ions, which are positively charged species, or protons, are a hydrogen atom that's lost its electron, and these are commonly shared between different kinds of molecules. So one water molecule can, for example, donate a hydrogen ion to another water molecule, or vice versa. We can, in very general terms, trifurcate the universe into molecules that love to donate these protons or hydrogen ions, and these are called acids. Those that love to receive them, and these are called bases, and those that don't really care one way or other, and we generally just call those neutral molecules. And so we have acids that like to give protons, bases that like to accept them, and neutrals that don't care one way or the other. So different acids and different bases donate or accept a proton or hydrogen ion to different degrees. Not all molecules behave the same way. And so we have a continuum, just to focus on acidity, we have a continuum from strongly acidic to weakly acidic. And to be able to define that, we have to utilize some sort of scale, some sort of metric of measure, and that is the pH scale. And so if you Google pH scale, you'll find some beautiful colored images ranging from highly acidic to highly basic. And there's many common foodstuffs and items that we can find at home that fit within this pH scale. So the strongest acid you might come across on a day-to-day basis is something like lemon juice. There we go, lemon juice. That has a pH of value of 3. Now, acids can have pH values of 0, which are much stronger. It is slightly counterintuitive, but the stronger the acid, the lower the number. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, what you might come across, a strong acid might be an example of lemon juice. If you've ever squirted lemon juice in your eye, you know that hurts a bit because that acid does react and does interact with the surface molecules in your eye, and so that stings. Tomatoes are less acidic, so they have a pH of about 5, maybe. Water is fairly neutral. It has a pH of, or pure water is neutral, has a pH of 7. And then we can go to things like antacids, which have a pH of about 8. all the way up to things like drain cleaners. So drain cleaners have a pH of about 14.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Dr. Bruce Gibb, explaining exactly how our emissions turn the ocean more acid.
So we've got this range of acidities from highly acidic 0 to 14, and everything exists in between those two extremes. Why do we have to be thinking about this? We have to be thinking about this because when CO2 in the atmosphere reacts with water, it forms a weak acid called carbonic acid. So we combine one CO2 molecule with one H2O molecule, and that makes carbonic acid. The two protons on that carbonic acid, those two H atoms, they are acidic, and carbonic acid wants to donate them to things. That means that rainwater is actually slightly acidic. It's about pH 5.6. So, you know, we don't dissolve. That's not a high pH, but it is a pH. It says there's a surplus of these protons or hydrogen atoms in the raindrop. In contrast, if you go to the ocean, then we find that the pH of the ocean is about 8.1. It is slightly basic. It's beyond pH 7. And that is because the ocean, as we all know, when we've swallowed a mouthful of it, is filled with a variety of salts. And those variety of salts, en masse, tend to accept protons rather than donate protons. So they're bases rather than acids. And that pH value is above 7, it's pH of about 8. So when we actually dissolve CO2 in water, whether it's in the atmosphere or whether you're making some carbonated water at home with a soda stream or an equivalent device in your kitchen, we're actually doing a small chemical reaction. It's not just a matter of doing sodium chloride with salt. When you add salt to water, you're simply dissolving it. But with carbon dioxide, you're dissolving it and it's undergoing a reaction. And so what you end up with, carbon dioxide in water actually makes 5 species. And that's where it gets a little bit more complicated than we maybe would want to, because that leads to all these different names, such as carbonates and bicarbonates, and, you know, that does cause some confusion. But what do we have when we add CO2 into water? We have some carbon dioxide that's just dissolved. We have water, of course. But again, we formed carbonic acid, and that carbonic acid is an acid. It wants to donate protons, and so it does. It donates protons or hydrogen ions, and in the process, it forms what is called hydrogen carbonate or bicarbonate, and so that's baking soda, basically. That is a negatively charged species, and it's a weak base, so it can accept that proton again. You can go backwards if you wish. But let's not think about that. You can also lose the second proton, and that forms carbonate. And carbonate is an ion, which is part of calcium carbonate, which, of course, is chalk and limestone and all these other things I've mentioned. And we can form a variety of other salts. But in the ocean, en masse, there's more of these salts than there are of the carbonic acid that rains down on them from the sky. And so you literally have raindrops reacting with the carbonates in the ocean to have this very, very microscopically sized acid-base reaction, whereby you change the composition of the ocean just a little bit. Now, that's gone on since time immemorial. The problem is that we are releasing more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And that larger amounts of carbon dioxide are raining down on the ocean, which again is slightly basic, And so it's being made more acidic by this acid falling into it. And that rate is increasing, of course, with the more CO2 we pump out, the more rain is acidic, the more the oceans are acidified. Now, when we're talking acidification, we're not talking about making anything like tomato juice or, you know, pH of 5. We're just talking about small incremental shifts. So again, the oceans are pH of 8.1. That pH is not fixed, and the ocean's a big place, and mixing occurs. And so it ranges from about pH 7.8 to about 8.2. But that number is coming down a little bit, just by 0.1 or 0.2 pH units so far. So maybe down to 7.8 or a little bit below, again, depending on which part of the ocean you're in. But that acidification does have ramifications for everything that utilizes all the carbonate in the water. That's a very long answer to a very...
No, actually, that was a very clear explanation, and I think I've appreciated that cycle better now than I grasped it before, so thank you for that. Does freshwater input from melting glaciers increase or reduce acidity, and does glacial input matter for the global acidification problems you raise?
The answer is no and yes. Did I get that the right way around? So when a glacier melts, you're adding considerable amounts of fresh water into the sea, and that does affect the net pH, and so it gets diluted, and so the acidity does decrease somewhat, so it counters all this CO2 that we're dissolving. The problem is a matter of scale. You know, 96%, 98%, I can't quite remember the number, of all water on Earth is salt water. And so the quantities that we're dealing with are relatively small, at least globally. Now, that's not to say you cannot affect a local environment. If you have a fjord where the currents in the ocean are relatively limited, then a glacier melting into that can dilute the salts in the ocean and therefore change the net pH. So locally, yes, potentially. You know, if there's a sudden melting of a glacier and a sudden change in the pH of the water, albeit a small one, that can be a shock to the local marine life that utilizes or relies on that pH being more or less constant. But globally, you know, it sort of washes out, for want of a better term.
Bruce, hopefully some listeners today will be alive in the year 2100. Assuming reducing emissions takes several decades, do we know how much more acidic the ocean could be?
The short answer is no. There are physical limits. So if you've ever used a soda stream or seen somebody operate a soda stream and you've heard that the machine burp at you when you've pumped in as much carbon dioxide as you can, that is literally because you have put in as much carbon dioxide as you can. So there is an absolute limit. Now, that absolute limit is somewhere around about pH 5 or 6. We will probably never get down to that level. We did. If we turned the oceans into something akin to tomato juice, then we would be, you know, in dire trouble. But there is this absorption process of these acids going on by the carbonate salt. Take a lot longer than, again, the rate we're putting it into the water. And so eventually it would compensate. So the term in chemistry we use is a buffer. And so a buffer is something that can handle changes, input of an acid or a base, without changing the net pH of this solution. And so those carbonates do react with the carbonic acid that gets added to the ocean, but slowly. I would say, overall, the rate by which we are adding carbon dioxide into the oceans is very fast, but not so fast that we would ever get down to that pH, that at some point the rate of neutralization of that acid would match the rate by which we're adding it. So, you know, the change in pH over the industrial revolution in the ocean has only been about 0.1 or 0.2 pH units. Sounds very small, but those are significant for reasons we can talk about. And so, you know, in theory, if you go down to, if you took all the ocean, all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and put it into fresh water, the volume of the ocean, you would drop the pH substantially, maybe down to 6 or something like that, very quickly. But, you know, there are carbonates in the salt that buffer, that counter these effects. And so we'll never get down to pH at that level. If we do, we won't be around to talk about it.
Well, getting to what I think is a key question, can ocean absorption of carbon dioxide keep up with human emissions? And is that the saturation horizon in the title of your essay?
Carbonates in the ocean come in two forms. Calcium carbonate comes as aragonite or calcite. These are the two main forms of carbonate in the ocean. And they have unusual solubility properties. They actually get more soluble the colder things get. And so at the bottom of the oceans, they are fully dissolved. But at the top of the oceans, they're saturated. And so there is too much calcium carbonate to dissolve. And that's one of the reasons, or probably the prime reason, why Mother Nature utilizes carbonates to build phytoplankton shells and crustacean shells, because it's there. At a certain point, though, between this area where there's excess calcium carbonate and areas where it's fully dissolved, there is what is called the saturation horizon. And that's just simply the level by which you go from one state of affairs to the other. And marine biologists, and I'm not a marine biologist, but marine biologists and geochemists think of this saturation horizon because it's important for life. If you're above the saturation horizon, say somewhere near the surface, you've got energy from the sun and you've got this calcium carbonate that you can utilize to grow your exoskeleton or shell, and that's great. But if you go below the saturation horizon, then all of a sudden you're in a zone where the calcium carbonate will just start to dissolve, because it's more soluble in the lower parts of the ocean. And so the saturation horizon is for many life forms a sort of cutoff zone. You don't want to go below this because you can't keep up building your crustacean shell, for example, at the rate that you're losing calcium carbonate because it's just more soluble. Now, most compounds, you know, table salt is more soluble at higher temperatures. Sugar is likewise. That's very normal. Calcium carbonate is rather unique, or at least rare, that it's more soluble at colder temperatures at the bottom of the ocean. So, yeah, the saturation horizon not only defines the level of the saturation horizon, not only defines a sort of crude differentiation between where life can thrive and where life has a little bit more difficulty, but it also tells us that that level changes according to pH. And so we can also get an understanding of not only the habitability of a particular part of the ocean or a particular depth of the ocean, but we get an idea of the chemistry, the concentrations of calcium carbonate by defining the saturation horizon and seeing how that changes from locale to locale or year to year.
You know, a lot of the studies and conversations tend to focus on threats to species living in the sea, but I wonder, as a chemist, do you see other reactions to acidifications developing, like changes in minerals, new chemical processes, or even alterations to currents or ocean mixing?
So that's a complicated question, or questions. So in terms of ocean currents and all that, the jury's still out. We don't really know how changes in pH are going to affect such things as ocean current. It's maybe not directly tied to pH, but when you're changing the speciation in water, again, you've got these very simple level five things: water, carbon dioxide, carbonic acid, hydrogen carbonate, and then carbonate. Those have there's a speciation, relative percentages of each one, that changes as a function of temperature and pH, and things like density also are affected. So, you know, changes in the pH may affect, will affect the speciation, which will affect the density of the solution, and that may affect currents. Those sorts of things, you know, we just haven't really explored yet. In terms of new processes, no, not really. The carbonate buffer, which is what the ocean basically is, the chemistry of that is fairly well described. That's not to say pH changes, small pH changes can't have huge effects, but in terms of brand new chemistry, no, that's not really a thing. But the simple fact is we just don't know for sure what's going to happen. We can maybe guess at the chemistry and know what's going on quite accurately. But the real hard part is understanding how life responds to that change in chemistry. You know, a crustacean might use a protein for sequestering the calcium carbonate in the ocean to help build its shell. And that protein may sequester at a certain rate. And we don't know what that rate may necessarily be. And so changes to the speciation in the water can affect that rate. And so, you know, some animals will likely thrive and others will suffer as a result of this change in acidity. So we can go back to, you know, if we go back quite a long time to, let's say, 56 odd million years ago, I believe, the Paleocene Eocene thermal maximum. This was a period when the Earth warmed 6 to 8 degrees centigrade for about 200,000 years or so. And that was associated with a massive input of carbon into the oceans from the atmosphere. And that had, you know, significant consequences. There were mass extinctions of many of the small dinoflagellates and phytoplankton. There were changes to the morphology of these. There were undoubtedly species that thrived as well. And so, you know, that's an area of earth sciences I don't know anything about, but it is an active area of research looking at the soil samples or mud core samples and looking to see how these populations of these small marine life forms changes and how they changed in response to periods of time such as the Paleocene, Eocene. So we know that's going to happen. The slightly worrying thing about the burning of fossil fuels is that although the Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum was a very rapid process, our addition of CO2 into the atmosphere is far more rapid than that. And so we really haven't probably seen yet the effects on life form populations because that will take time to pan out. But by changing the pH of the ocean, you are favoring some species and disfavoring others. And the question is, what are the consequences of that? You know, that are phytoplankton's response are responsible for almost half the oxygen that we breathe. And so, you know, if you're affecting that population, or all those populations of phytoplankton in a negative way, then you lose half your oxygen. You know, I don't think the world will ever get that bad, but these changes are occurring and will occur.
We are starting to run low on time, but I do want to ask Bruce Gibb, do you think we can fix this? Are there geoengineering ideas to control acidity in the ocean, and would that be a good idea?
You know, that's sort of getting slightly almost philosophical. You know, geoengineering, for me personally, is a sort of scary process. Again, it's a matter of scale. So, you know, if you look at some of the carbon dioxide scrubbers that have been built, the one in Iceland whose name is escaping me, that runs on geothermal energy. You know, the amount of CO2 that these things can absorb. You know, this is a big plant that serves the whole country. And you would literally need a million of these in order to maintain this current CO2 level rather than, and more than that, if you were to actually decrease the amount of. It's a relatively benign technology, but it's whistling in the wind in many respects. I mean, the only true answer to avoiding this is simply to stop burning stuff and to limit our further future carbon dioxide emissions. You know, we blow in through the 1.5 degree limit set by the Paris Accords, by the looks of things. Preliminary data for the last 3 years, that average is slightly over 1.5. You know, if we get up to 4 degrees of warming, that's a lot of carbon dioxide, and that's correspondingly a big pH change in the ocean. And, you know, how all these things feed together, we're just barely starting to understand. So is geoengineering a good idea? If we're just removing CO2 in a benign way, then in theory, yes. But the scale is just, you know, tremendous. There's no getting around the fact that as a species, we have burned a lot of hydrocarbons and created a lot of concrete. Readers may not appreciate this, but concrete is number 2 or 3 on the list of human emissions that are difficult to address. In theory, we can turn to renewables in the next 10 or 20 years fully, and that takes care of that. But, you know, there are other CO2 emissions than just burning fossil fuels. And so concrete, we're building in New York City every month for the next 40 years or something. That's how much concrete we're making. All that generates vast quantities of CO2. So the scale of the problem is just, unfortunately, really difficult to address. And, you know, as a chemist, you know, we can go into the lab and do an experiment. If things go horribly wrong, then, you know, you lose a day's work and you come back the next day. That's not something, you know, as the old saying goes, there is no planet B. So I'm not a big fan of geoengineering in general terms, although there could be some specifics that are useful, such as just CO2 sequestration. But again, the scale is just almost impossible. You know, how do we address this problem? It's not something that I've seen us capable of doing. And, you know, I'd love to find some solutions, but I don't think they're there.
From Tulane University in New Orleans, we've been speaking with chemist Dr. Bruce Gibb. Find links to the paper and my notes at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday. Bruce, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. This has been a delight. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Looking at weird waves of extreme record heat and cold circulating Earth this winter of 25-26, I was wondering, are we seeing something new? How would we know, with only the past as a guide and a system so variable as weather? There's a lot of strange weather in the Northern Hemisphere, including continental splits with rough cold winter blusters in the north and unusual near-summer weather in the south. We see that in North America and in Europe. Cold in Germany, sizzling in Crete, new January high record. Turkey and southwest Russia hot. But the real kicker was blaring dangerous heat in South Australia. The government was freaking out about fire risks so extreme it is off the charts. And indeed, some fires flared up. Our guest next week on growing wildfire risk around the world just told me temperatures around his home reached 45 degrees C. That is 113 degrees Fahrenheit. Crazy stuff happens to the environment when that happens. Unprotected people without AC will die. So will a lot of other species. Oh, and a tropical cyclone hit Queensland. It's hell weather in parts of Australia. We all hope this is not another black summer. Maybe our Aussie listeners and friends will get through this one this year. When global warming drives widespread change to the whole ecosystem, these are called bioclimatic extremes. That's a new phrase. You haven't heard it. It came out in a January 7th paper about bioclimatic extremes in the Arctic. And so that is where we are, friends. We have to invent new labels for climate-driven extremes previously unknown to current Earth systems. Sure, we're entering an era of bioclimatic extremes. Already on this planet, wildfires burn so intensely that forests are not coming back. Landscapes get washed away by record extreme rains in a day. The coral world nursery to a quarter of all sea life is dying and disappearing in hot, acidic seas. You may be insulated by the residue of carbon colonial wealth. You see, most of us did colonize the atmosphere. We spread our waste into the air and sea somewhere else for decades, over a century. Carbon-based history subsidizes most of us for food and our transportation system and all that. Most of us have that buffer against the first storms of climate change. Most of us will be okay. Others in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the Pacific Islands are already going under that wave of heat, floods, drought, storms, and of course, just the acid sea. In a minimal economy, millions of people slide further into poverty until millions flee. Only a few in the West are getting burned out or storm-wrecked. We absorb the first punches, but nature is always the champion. The bioclimate always wins. For now, the pressing need is to decarbonize, right now, fast, and adapt. That requires rebuilding community, and that's not easy. Eventually, if we fail to refocus politics into the demands of reality and common good, then this is, well, it's not yet, but comes the time for survival during possible blackout breakdown. Isolated TikTokers and screenminders do not know how to grow food or shelter during extremes, how to survive on small power like a solar panel and a battery, how to find firewood or drinkable water, how to work with insects and microbes without killing them all. It takes 7 years to train a doctor. Maybe it takes 7 years to rebuild a person capable of living in their actual environment as a cooperating part of it. It takes 7 years to construct a new economy and larger politics, not built on death. Prepare for a long struggle where the outcome is unknown. Thank you for listening and being part of this community that learns from science. Next week, we will not be talking about the latest outrage on the net. Instead, we face a demon already coming out of climate change, a new regime of wildfires. Please tune in next week for Radio EcoShock.
One fine day, kids in play. Air smells funny, eyes get sore.
Fire,
fire time.
Concrete ruin, ground made flat.
The empty lot, empty space. Kids once played. One fine day,
fire comes quick. Does it ever go away? In my mind, in lover's eyes, fire feels.
Sky turned red, a wall of flames filled my head.
Sad.